Hey, good morning, everyone. Let me call the council study session of Thursday, November 1st, 2007 to order. Hope everybody had fun with the trick-or-treaters last night. I know my neighborhood was inundated. It was, I thought there was a parade out on the street in front. There were so many people. So as I started running short of candy, I went to the cupboards and figured out what else you could hand out. And I think I went through bags of potato chips. And, so hopefully everybody else was a little bit better prepared. No. Let's go ahead and go through the study session agenda items. We have eight in front of us. The first is to review items on the agenda for the November 5th regular council meeting. So let's go ahead and find that information in the packet. Should have a little blue tab on top. First page is basically just the prayer pledge and welcoming. Page two. Any questions on page two? 5A will have some discussion, I believe, here today, too. This isn't the home rule portion, though. This is just the regular election. Okay. All right. Page 2. Anything on page 3? We get into liquor licenses. On 7E?
Yes.
Right. What's the status of that?
Mayor, this applicant for Pepper's Restaurant has asked the state for an extension. And so that we're asking that this license application be continued until the November 19th meeting.
Okay, why don't we read it in as such, as a continuance to November 19th then?
Okay.
Right. Okay. That's page 3. Page 4 with contracts. Contracts are continued on page 5. And 6, I believe 9K, potential conflict for myself. Okay. That would be page 6. Page 7, additional contracts. Page 8, get into the introduction and setting November 19th as the date for the public hearing and the potentially adoption of ordinances. Page 9, additional ordinance introduction. Page 10, resolutions. Again, everything's suggested for consent. And that takes us over to page 11. Vice Mayor.
Just a question. On 11G, the STS program, we're getting additional. Who's doing STS this morning? Nobody's doing STS.
Yeah. Jeff was hired. Where'd he go?
Well, that's okay. I'll contact Jeff later. It just looks like we're getting.
Sitting right in the middle.
Jeff, are you doing STS this morning?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
I'll be awake this morning.
Too much sugar last night.
My apologies. It's early.
We need John Perkinson to tell you to wake up. Item 11G on the STS program, funding the amount. It looks like we're getting increased trips with no increased cost.
Yes, that's right.
What is wrong with that picture?
Well, they actually reduced the cost that they charge us per trip from the previous year. I think there may have been an error in the way they were calculating it, and so the cost went down slightly.
Even with the gasoline prices going up?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, that's fabulous news. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then on page 12, could we pull 12C, please? I'll be consistent in my monument sign position. Try to sneak that back through there, though. Any questions on any of the agenda items? Okay. Let's go on then to hear a presentation and discuss the West Main Street Neighborhood Area Plan.
Mayor and Council, if I may, I'm going to kick things off a little bit as the staff comes forward to talk about this. Approximately 2 years ago, we were before the council and received direction to begin working on this neighborhood area plan in preparation for the light rail coming in and being able to address redevelopment in the area and providing for transit-oriented development. We were a little bit delayed in getting started because we were still finishing up the Lehigh and the Falcon Field sub-area plans, but we did get started on this in April of 06. Been working since then with the community, with the Planning Advisory Committee, in preparing a plan for the area. You've received now a draft of that plan for you to begin to look at and become familiar with. We are going to the November P&Z meeting for their review and hopefully recommendation at that time of the document onto you. Hopefully back in December for formal consideration of the plan. So this morning we want to give you an overview of some of the key points that are in there and the process we've been through to get to this point and see if you have any questions. So with that introduction, I'll turn it over to Hector, who's our GIS administrator and long-range planning manager. Hector.
Yeah, thank you, John. First, before we start, let me introduce our staff members that have been working with us for a while. Savi Kapoor, to my right, with my left there, she started about 5 months ago, and she has been working really hard, putting all the pieces together and getting information, calling and everything. And Wahid, as you know, has been doing other sub-area plans in the past. Examples are Citrus, a sub-area plan, the Lehigh, you remember Lehigh, and also the Falcon Field. So after many months working on this area, talking with neighborhood, getting to meetings, now we're going to give you a little outline of the summary of the plan. So Wahid, with this, start.
Good morning, Mayor and Council members. As John mentioned, in 2005, you guys told us to go and work with the community, basically to facilitate, to guide the light rail development in and around that area. And with consultation and with input from two major organizations, Mesa Grande organizations and West Mesa CDC, we basically created a PAC member committee, we say like Planning Advisory Committee, and we met them regularly. I think the last one was the 16th meeting we met with them. So that's how the process started. The boundary, as you all know, we came to City Council and got adopted the boundary. The boundary is basically University Drive on the north, Country Club on the east, and then Tempe Canal or Tempe Border on the west, and Broadway on the south. This is kind of like a 2.5 acres area, 2.5 square mile area. And the light rail, as you see, we'll get one station. As all of you know, it's the Sycamore and Main next to that old Tri-City Mall area and Evitt area. That's where we're getting our light rail station. This is an area, roughly 14,000 people live here. We saw the maximum population change from 90 to 2000. After that, it's kind of a plateau. So, since 2000 census, not a whole lot of population increased here happened. And I'll go through the process quickly a little bit because it's an elaborative process. It's almost like, as John said, we started last year, 2006, and we are almost coming to a close conclusion now, going to the City Council for adoption probably in December. We had, as I mentioned earlier, we had the PAC meetings, 16th of the meeting. We met with regularly with this representative of the community, and we acted as a facilitator. Mostly it's the community visions, and a lot of input came in. And in different format, those input came in. One is obviously this small group that we met regularly. There is another format was the community meetings, which were bigger meetings advertised, which we had in Webster Elementary School, we had in EVIT, East Valley Institute of Technology. We had even community forums assisted by Mesa Community College public forum. I forgot the exact section. But through that, we had the public forum, and then also we had expert panel workshop. Basically, we invited from the Valley people who did this type of project, TOD ordinance, TOD project in Phoenix and other areas, to share with us what is their plus and minus about these type of projects and what can they expect from the city and the community. So that way, our last community meeting was September the 11th, and we had a lot of comments, good comments, and frankly speaking, I was surprised. I haven't seen in any of these community meetings 85 people showed up, outside staff, just the local residents and businesses. In our process, we updated council, we updated Downtown Development Committee, we updated Planning and Zoning Board before even coming to for actions or vote. Recently, in October 25th, that PAC recommended this draft plan for approval, so that's why we are coming to council for your updating you. And then also, like in November 15th, we'll go to Planning and Zoning Board and the DDC for their recommendations to the council. And hopefully, we would like to come in December 3rd to the council for actions. The intent of this plan is basically to proactively guide the emerging forces of change in this area. As we know, light rail is coming. And they're not limited, but there are two major things happening, the arrival of the light rail and the departure of some of the automobile users. So those are kind of like two forces acting here, the changes. So the community, knowing those forces, worked with us and identified their vision of this area. Their vision of this area is of a close-knit community where history is respected. As we all know, this is an area has a lot of history. And also they want to embrace the changes like light rail. With that, they all know that change will happen. So they're excited. They want to work with this change. And of course, we all know this is an area has diversity in all level, from racial diversity to signage to architectural style, anything you can name it. This is an area that has all these diversity. And interestingly, this area has these old and new that commingle peacefully. Placemaking is a big item on our plan. Unlike other plants, like let's say citrus and Lehigh, I would mention, is this is a plan that is to create a place that will continue this history and other that I just mentioned that represent its people and community in future also. So it's not only in the past. And I'm not going to go to all these detail, but this is kind of mentioning that placemaking involves all these issues. And this is not just creating a place appealing. It has more than that. It's the people, it's the history, it's the lifestyle and all that. The plan elements, we touched all this, and I know we give you a plan, draft plan, has all these elements in it, placemaking, land use, transportation, historic preservation, open space, public infrastructure and design. Obviously, public infrastructure is a big element. You'll see when we come to the recommendation area also that the key factors, transportation and land use also. I think those three things are kind of the big ones that will change. Based on all that discussions with the community, this is how currently looks like the proposed plan is. The dark blue ones are the station areas. We have one station area, as I mentioned, Sycamore Transit Center. Those areas are based on 606 feet or 5 minutes walk, and of course community input and all that. The final boundary might change because of the opt-out and all the other ordinances issue comes in. But right now for policy, this is the area has been identified as station area. And the other two, as you see, we don't have light rail yet, but we are all going through the high capacity study. So whatever gets decided will be here. If the light rail comes in, so we are planning for those stations. If light rail doesn't come in, if it's a rapid bus transit, those are the stations that will take care of it. The lighter blue is the corridor area for light rail, acknowledging that this area will also have redevelopment and changes may not be as intense as the station areas. And of course, the purple one is along the freight line, Union Pacific Rail, it's all the industrial development, which is mostly, you can see today, there's not a whole lot of new area to develop here. But, and then of course, the yellow color is the residential, where a lot of those neighborhoods are very mature, they want to be preserved, and rightfully, we work on the plan on based on that. These are some of the recommendations based on that plan I mentioned, just like that TOD station area, which is those small areas arranged on a five-minute walk, 606 feet distance from the station. This is where I think we have challenge, everybody has challenge. It's a different mindset, it's a different urban pattern, it's a different development pattern that we are not used to seeing it here yet in Mesa a whole lot. Means it's a mixed use. It's a high-density development. You have, like, typically you have ground floor with retail and restaurants and public dealings mostly. Then on the upstairs, you have residential and offices. That's what we anticipate here. You have commercial intensity, residential density, and building height. All of these has to play here and really take advantage of a light rail, because it doesn't make sense if you have a light rail station or a bus station and everything around you is only 6 units per acre. You're not taking advantage of that. Some of these examples, I know we don't have it here, but I hope like 5 years from now I can bring an image here and say that's Mesa. The corridor area, it's a little bit less intense from the station relatively, but still taking the advantage because people can walk and go to the stations, and the lifestyle that we're talking about, pedestrians on the ground floor and all those pedestrian activities. It's a little bit moderate density, still mixed use. Residential and building height will be a play. In this area, we talk at this point, the plan is talking about two-story minimum, five-story maximum. The station area that we just talked about, the plan right now is looking at minimum three-story, but maximum, they don't want to keep a cap. They say, like, we'll look at it based on each project comes in. 30 dwelling units per acre here. 17 dwelling units per acre in the corridor area. The overall corridor area has some common recommendations that we want to stress, like pedestrian-oriented environment, pocket parks. This cannot be the old thinking that we always have to have a 5-acre and a 10-acre piece to call it a public park. We have to go into, like, maybe half an acre piece. I don't know. Great example, Mesa Drive and Main Street. Next to that Wells Fargo, tiny place, next to Fish and Chip. It's very active. It's not a 10-acre piece. It's not a public park. So those type of examples, the community want to use them. The parking is another big thing. We are always used to surface parking. This type of development cannot be based on surface parking only. We have to go into alternative mode of parking, like basement parking, structure parking, podium parking, shared parking, all kinds of creative way of doing parking, and also reduce parking standards from the current. We have an example, not yet built. Council just approved the one, West Mesa Station Village on Main Street. This will fall on the corridor area that we just mentioned. So when it's built, we'll have more information and we can share with you. But this is how it has retail on the ground floor and has residential on the top. Other examples from outside Mesa, like in Texas, you can see the before and after picture here on Plano, Texas, and then the other one is the Cedar Station, Dallas. I mean, you can see the high-rise play of the pocket park and all those good things we are expecting here. The plan implementation, yes, council told us go and work with the community, and we did that, so let's say we create a draft plan. But what next? I think that's what is more important. Unless these things are done, this plan cannot be implemented. We think we need to amend the Mesa General Plan, so anybody is interested in redeveloping in this area doesn't have to deal piece by piece minor general plan amendment, so they can get into the whole idea is to expedite and make the process simpler. As long as they agree with the plan, go ahead. Start building. Almost that's the concept. But if you don't agree with the plan, you still can go and work with us and see, and prove us that your plan is better than us and go through all the process of amending. The next item is, of course, create a TOD ordinance. We are working with our consultant any week, I think. We'll get the draft plan, and once we get the draft ordinance, we'll work on it because we need the ordinance still. The ordinance will be still flexible enough so the people who are in the station area, let's say, the landowners, they can opt in and opt out, and of course we'll have to work with them in crafting this ordinance, TOD ordinance. Plan for capital improvement infrastructure. Time and again we met with community, we met with experts, and everybody kind of comes in a conclusion that the infrastructure, the streetscape, and all that has to be public funded. And I know it's not always acceptable to us is where is the money or we don't have the money approach, but still that's one consensus came from all the meetings is plan for your capital improvements now. And then the other thing was creation of a board or a committee to act as the keeper of the vision. The community believes that that kind of board or committee can carry out and be the committee who will look after the interest of these area, almost like they gave example like Historic Preservation District has a board or downtown has a board, that kind of thing. We haven't, this plan doesn't recommend anything yet. This is just a recommendation from the community. I know we'll work with the council. There could be many alternatives. It could be that council formally does one board, or it could be the informal boards like, for example, Citrus, Lehigh. Those are also today looked after by the private organizations. It's not like a city-created board. Encourage public-private partnership. Some options there for federal, to work with the federal government or the Valley Metro, but beyond that, the community thinks that we should explore more public-private partnership, maybe with the community college, maybe with EVIT. Hasn't been finalized yet, but those they want to, or maybe with the community development corporations. Assist small property owners, the last bullet is here with land assembly, conceptual site plan, appropriate zoning. This is an area like mostly if you can visualize all those little property along University and Main, there are some which mostly residentially originally planned. It's not functioning best for residential lifestyle. That's why you'll always see conversion into offices. But at the same time, because of their lot size, it's almost like a residential lot. So they are not attractive for redevelopment also. And then always the challenge goes in, you know, that land assembly. So instead of us always being reactive, means we get a proposal in a half an acre lot for an office, and from Solid West, engineering, planning, everybody hammers on their standards, and ultimately it comes out to be unbuildable. So it stays like that for another 30 years. So here is an option is we can assist, work with these landowners and see if there is a possibility of land assembly, appropriate zoning, because right now they are R16 and you cannot work on those, some of those. So these are some of the plan implementations. And here are some dates I want to share with you, the upcoming meetings. As I mentioned, November 15th, we are taking this plan for recommendations from PNZ and DDC, and we anticipate to come back to you for action on December 3rd. That concludes my presentation. If you have any questions and comments.
Let me start out with a few. The capital improvements and infrastructure, some of the densities that are required, how much are you anticipating for sewer and water and rebuilds in order to accommodate anything along Main Street that dramatically changes the densities?
Mayor and Council Member, we share all this information with our utility infrastructure divisions. They all looked at it. They created their map. I haven't found any comment that says significantly change, because there are some capacities that are not totally captured. For example, they shared with us, like Motorola left. So Motorola had the gigantic demand for water. So this area, even with our anticipated density and intensity, can take care by the infrastructure. I'm sure there are minor improvements that they have to change, but no significant big item this way.
Your suggestion as the city to become involved in the facilitating land assemblage, I'd just as soon pass on that. If people want to talk to each other and get together and assemble land, that's fine, but I'm not sure I want to be a broker or get involved in that in virtually any way that I can see. I mean, that's my personal opinion. That's not our role. And I mean, we can have the zoning and approve higher densities if that comes to pass to maybe enhance their value to assemble, but to actually get involved in the assemblage, I would be very reluctant to go that direction.
And
I think what will drive some of the assemblage of the small parcels is you have numerous larger parcels, car dealerships and such, that have moved to the freeway locations. Lots of the old motels, that when it was a highway and now it's more of a resident or an urban street that doesn't have the same type of traffic that goes down it looking for rooms. I think there's some fairly significant parcels in some of those corridors, especially on the Main Street corridor, that are just ripe for redevelopment in this area with, in most cases, one owner. So I think once those are captured and changed, I think the assemblage will come in its own right, and I would be reluctant to be very proactive in any way as a municipality to do that. The last question I have is, on your map, I agree with you on the Sycamore Station. Obviously, that's a major park and ride, and that's the destination, and there's a light rail. But you also have indicated, I believe, Alma School in Maine. Are we submitting all of those locations for transit stops? Or are we going to have some distance between them before? Because I also am concerned about the speed of which that light rail system gets from one end of the town to the other. And if we put every mile, we put station stops on it, I think that may restrict the speed also. So I would be questioning whether you need them every mile. And you may do something mid-block instead of on the intersection, a mile and a half or 2 miles apart, where we have some large vacant parcels today that a landowner sees the benefit of having a transit stop right next to his development. So I would, as you're going through this plan, look at the redevelopment potential of large parcels that are underused currently or landowners that are willing to work with the transit-oriented development as part of their, or they would encourage being the location for a transit stop. Mm-hmm. So those would be my comments. I appreciate moving forward. I do believe that with the investment, it's obvious that if you have a light rail line and you have that much investment, you're not going to be moving it. So whoever invests next to it is going to know that it's going to be there for at least the duration of whatever project they build. So I think it does have some promise, and it will give people another lifestyle choice if they desire to do it. Vice Mayor.
Thanks, Mayor. I attended the meeting that we had at EVIT on this, and the work that was done by this committee is great. I think in terms of the land assemblage, I know that was one that people were concerned about. I think that the West Mesa CDC might be the entity that could really help people in the land assemblage thing rather than the city. The other thing that came up over and over again, and I'm not sure if it's because people just didn't look at this or if it was because it needs to be restated 200 times, and that is this whole issue of the opt-in, opt-out zoning, that we are not going in and saying to people, well, yeah, that's what you have right now, but you have to go rip that out and you have to go build something else. What we're trying to do is facilitate their being able to use their land in a more optimal way.
That's correct.
And we are not kicking anybody out of their mobile home. We're not, and that one came up because we said that the committee said that they did not envision any new mobile home parks being built in that area. That was not part of what they thought was a good design for along the light rail corridor. And as a result, I know there were some people who lived in existing mobile homes who thought that the city was then saying, we're not going to let you live there anymore. None of that was what was going on here. It was trying to offer opportunities for people to optimize the use of their land along this light rail corridor. And the opportunities the mayor talked about are the great opportunities that are possible here. The timeline for development here is going to be years and decades. It's not going to be months and weeks. And I didn't turn my cell phone off. Excuse me. Well, I'm done, Mayor. Thank you.
Well, maybe somebody was disagreeing with that statement. All right. Tom?
I agree on the mayor's comments about the land assembly, because what concerns me about that is that we may say, gee, if we could just get these five pieces together, it would be really nice. But somebody comes in and they've acquired two of them and they want to do something. And I don't want us to be in a position of saying, no, we're not going to let you do what you want to do with your two pieces, because we think it would be better if you put five pieces together and we're here to help you do that. We've had development opportunities in downtown with some land that we own that we tell people, no, we don't want to sell it to you because we don't like exactly what you're going to do there. I just don't want to get us into that kind of micromanagement process. And I don't suspect this is going to be a surprise to anybody. I appreciate the hard work that everybody put into this, but you know, Claudia talked about this offers opportunities, and the mayor used the same phrase. And it seems to me what we're trying to do is we want to give people the opportunity to optimize the use of their land, but only within the context and within the framework and within the parameters and within the regulations that we're designing in this West Main Street area plan. So my plan is a little different. It's basically called the free market and get the hell out of the way. So, I mean, I know this is going to go forward and it's going to be approved by everybody. It's not going to be received favorably by me on December 3rd because I think it's an attempt to, I mean, we can achieve everything that you're trying to achieve here by just relaxing or eliminating the restrictions that are in place and letting the market dictate what goes there. So,
yes.
Mayor, Councilor, yeah, the intention of this plan is to do that, actually, is to be able to have more flexibility and to allow the development to happen easily instead of our restrictions. That's the intention of our plan, too.
And I appreciate that. You are allowing people to do things there that they can't do now, but you could achieve the same things by just getting rid of those restrictions, mm-hmm. not creating a whole other set of restrictions that say, okay, you can go 3 floors here and 5 floors here, but 2 floors here and 7 floors here and this density and that. I just don't agree with that kind of, and it's a philosophical thing, and I'm just singing the same song that I've sung since I got here.
Councilmember Truitt.
Well, kind of following up on that, you said something about two-story minimums and three-story minimums in districts. What is the reasoning behind that? Why place a minimum?
The reason, I think, one is that intensity that the community talked about. So let's say especially around the station and along the corridor. So if there is no minimum, that means people can go and build just one story. And everybody thought that the very question that you're not taking the opportunity of your land and intensity and you're not fully taking advantage of a transit corridor if you're building one story. That's why they thought, let's just establish at least the minimum one. Because right now, I don't think without the ordinance, you saw the example that three-story, there was no restrictions. They came up with that three-story. So I think that's another way of looking at it.
Go ahead, follow up.
The other is I'd like to see the map again. And I'll call it the royal blue color. How far north, in the areas that it comes down close to Main Street, mm-hmm. how far north of Main Street is that line drawn?
You're talking about this one station area?
No, the next blue color. The lighter blue.
Oh, how far north of the...
Yeah, it seems to parallel Main Street, but very close to Main Street.
Yeah, it's one property deep. All the commercial lots on north of the Main Street, because north of that is all residential. That's why you see those yellow color there.
I understand that. If we were going to adopt a general plan, or whatever we want to call a specific plan for this area, was the idea that you just didn't want to go more than one property north with any redevelopment?
If these are based on very established neighborhood tract homes there. So if somebody buys the whole subdivisions, sure. But right now, we don't anticipate each property owner selling their home and getting into this.
I do understand factor. You don't want to start intruding one parcel at a time. Okay.
I think you're hearing some comments, though, that if you have a minimum of 2 to 3 stories or something, and a landowner wants to build one, even though it's not economical for him to build one, you think his self-interest would say, I can get more floor area ratio and I can get a better return by doing 2 and 3. I think it's going to come automatically mm-hmm. if, in fact, the area is popular. So what I think we're hearing a little bit is maybe set a maximum height so that the height doesn't intrude visibility into the neighborhood. But I'm not sure I would do minimums. I mean, the minimum's up to the property owner to do with as they see. So, Tom.
If I can follow on that and what Daryl said, I mean, the phrase that you use, sir, is that we don't think you're maximizing the opportunity that you have with your own land. All right. That isn't our business, to tell them that they're not getting the maximum return on their land. They should be able to get the return that they want to get because they like doing whatever it is that they want to do. So I would not impose those limits, because to impose limits is the mayor has just said, a smart person may say, yeah, I can make more money here if I build a three-story building. But to tell him that he has to build a three-story building when he may not want to make that much money, or he may not want to optimize his land in that way, I just don't think that's an appropriate role for government.
Other comments? Kyle?
I think that's why they call it the opt-in, opt-out. Our role really should be to facilitate people to be able to do what they want to do. And knowing historically areas that have had transit-oriented development, you do have multiple stories. You do more optimum use of the land, and that's everyone's right. The property owner should do what they want. What we need to do is make it possible for them to do that. And what this plan is saying is, this is suggested outline of what we think would be best here, but you don't have to. That's why you can opt out and say, hey, it's my property, I'm going to do what I want, because bottom line is, we cannot force anybody to take a plan. So having a vision of what it looks like is great. Having a vision of what is possible there is great. We need to make it possible for those people to do what they want to do, and still, as it says, have the option where if they don't want to participate, they don't have to. But at least we give them the tools that will allow them to do a higher density, to do the transit-oriented development that really is what would be hoped for, but definitely not something forced on.
I'm sorry, Kyle, you raised a great issue, but I'm not sure that the opt-out, opt-in means that. I understand that applies to the existing landowners. But let's say somebody comes in and says, I want to buy two lots. They now have a minimum height requirement that applies to that property. The old property owner didn't opt out. So can they opt out as they buy in?
Yeah, Mayor and Councilmember House, this plan does not change the zoning or any properties. It's only a plan. It's an option, a tool for them to use, but there's no zoning changes at all.
Well, what about let's address the three-story height requirement in certain places, the minimum.
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, as Hector was describing, the plan itself is setting some vision, some goals, some direction that we would like to see for the community to go. To actually start to implement anything will take the creation of a TOD ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
And that ordinance, we're just starting to draft exactly what it will say and what the specific regulations are, we don't have yet, but it would certainly mimic the plan. Then from there, actually getting it applied to a piece of property, we are trying to determine a way that we can, and we haven't worked this all the way through legal yet, but what we've talked about, is there a way that the council could adopt the ordinance to the area, but then it's up to somehow each individual property owner to choose to apply then that to their property if they want to or not. And that's what we're seeing, if there's some way to do that. That's this opt-in business. We haven't tried to take it that next step to see when, if somebody later then buys the property, wants to opt out, probably just apply for rezoning would be what that opt back out would be, to take that zoning district off and use some other zone.
It sounds like you're struggling with it. It sounds problematic to me, but you know, I'm letting it go forward and see how it develops. But I'm expressing concerns here today.
Vice Mayor.
But let's not act like every place in the city, other than this place, you can build whatever you want, wherever you want. We call it zoning. You can't. If you come in and you buy a parcel that's zoned C2, we aren't going to let you build an M1 on there unless you come in for a rezoning. And so what we're saying is that people who have existing zoning, who want to continue to build, want to tear down whatever they have there, and they want to build with the existing zoning, they can do that. Mm-hmm. They also have the option under this plan, if we adopt it, of taking the new zoning without having to go through this whole plan amendment and all those kinds of things. Yeah. But if they want a completely different zoning than this zoning or the existing zoning, they're going to have to come through this council just like anybody else would, and look for new zoning. That isn't something different in the city. What's different here is that they have more than one option. If we go through with this plan, they have more than their current option. Exactly. They also have this option, and we want to tell them what that could look like, why it might be good for them, why it would be good for the community, and then they can make a choice based on what their best interests are. And if I've mischaracterized that, John, please feel free to...
Yes.
Okay.
Mayor, can I just clarify one thing? We use a lot of words like they and us and government, and I think one of the things that was most impressive to me in this presentation was the participation by the public. I don't believe that John and Waheed went into his cubicle and came up with this plan by themselves. So part of it is that I think we're trying to respect also the desires and wishes of the community. I'm assuming some of the property owners that we're talking about were involved in these discussions.
Oh, yes.
And we certainly need to make sure that they're weighing in on even these guidelines that we're putting in. Certainly it's a change. I don't think we're suggesting that we're trying to take over someone's property and dictate to them only what we think is correct. I think we've tried to figure out a way to bring the community in, recognizing there is significant changes taking place in this area, and I think what we're trying to do is get a consistent perspective on what the vision might be going out into the future. And I think the best way that I like to look at it is a tool, and hopefully we can use and figure out a way, I think where John's trying to go maybe even too, is how do we create like the incentives that encourage people to go to this vision that we all have, that we say we think we would be better off generally as a community, that's what the community seems to say, if this is where we, the direction we go. But I don't think we're suggesting anything that we're going to dictate absolutely that nobody can decide, you know, I really just don't buy into this TOD stuff, I want to build, you know, something else. So again, the vision is from the community. And we are here trying to implement and bring forward the outline of what we've heard from the community also.
The map that was alluded to before, and I know there was one project that came through from zoning, the discussion on that is kind of where's the transition? Is it the existing commercial on the front, or should it go to First Street? I think that's the first. And then you have a block and you have a little different access, and then you have the street buffer instead of just a wall and a backyard buffer. Was that input received from the neighborhood on what's the best transition to keep the vitality of the neighborhood intact but yet do a land assemblage that makes sense? Because I know that we fought that on the building placement for the overlook because of the height.
Right, exactly. Mayor, those lot of discussions was there mostly that I call that conflict area. Whatever you do,
correct.
If you have residential in the back, just like the typical example on Main, mm-hmm. you have residential on the north and then you have swath of land commercial along Main. Whatever you do, whether it's one story even, you'll have controversy because it's conflicting with residential and commercial. Most of the time, I think the solution is in the design, how you do it, the height, as you mentioned, whether you have windows looking in the backyard, things like that. And we even exercise one meeting of saying is, that's why the land assembly and indirectly came in. I'm sorry, I know it sounded differently. We are not going there as a broker to land assembly, but the concept was always that those individual lots, unfortunately, I don't have a magnifying mm-hmm. process here, but those, as you could see, like you have all those property, single family homes backing into commercial.
Right.
Then you have a road that parallels there. Well, at one time was even discussion is, can those single family homes on the south of the local road join the commercial? So that way you don't have, mm-hmm. so whatever you build in the commercial, then you're not looking at somebody's backyard, you're looking at a public road, and you're looking at people's front yard, which is probably not the best, but at least better than what's today. But those need time to work out because we don't have the plan yet adopted. If the plan gets adopted, this gives us the opportunity slowly talk with the community, talk with the individual property owners, see if we can only, as you know, we can only act as an assistant or facilitator. We're not going there buying the land and doing anything. So those were discussed, but at the end, the decision was not to say only two stories, so many feet from, and that can be addressed in the ordinance. That's where we think it's appropriate. Right now, it's just more policy and vision.
Right. Did the neighborhood like the concept of stopping at a street instead of stopping at a backyard?
I know John was there in those meetings. I have a feeling that I got both reactions. But then, of course, we didn't invite every property owners there. These are some representatives. Obviously, their home is not there. Their home is inside somewhere. So the discussion was mostly like, well, some people think like, that's not a best idea. They won't
got a
like
mixed.
It. Yeah, and some people think that's a great idea because it goes up to the public streets inside.
All right. Tom?
Just very briefly to respond to a point that Chris made, the distinction between the government and the community, and I appreciate that distinction, but the individual property owner and his right to do his with his property what he wants needs protection from both the government and the community.
Other discussion?
I just want to understand the process because I've been involved in a lot of this stuff. It seems like we talk about it, this feeling that we're just setting this vision, but the next thing we do is we change the general plan to incorporate the vision, and now it seems to be a little more codified, which basically says, as I understand it, if we go along that path where we first adopt the plan, then we adopt the general plan that permits the plan to be implemented, I suppose, or revise the general plan. And then what I'm understanding is that someone can either A, develop their property with existing zoning in place, or B, develop their property consistent with the general plan, which is consistent with the vision. Is that an oversimplification?
Let John answer that. I can add.
Mayor, Councilmember Truitt, pretty close. What we're thinking that we need is a new land use plan category. We recently created the mixed-use community to help facilitate some of those large parcel mixed-use type developments. The existing mixed-use categories that we have, mixed-use employment, mixed-use residential, given the small lots that we're dealing with, doesn't work very well. We're envisioning a new mixed-use category that could be applied along Main Street that would allow for the variety of commercial office residential uses that we'd like to see more easily, comply that land use category. All the zoning is still the same. And then then we would create the TOD district for those station areas, find the way to working with the property owners to get that applied to properties that are interested. Then as it evolves in the future, we would have those tools in place. The person could apply for a rezone, whatever zoning they need, consistent with the plan, which, again, the plan should be pretty flexible mix of uses along that corridor and then develop accordingly.
So I guess that goes back to the statement that I made before. I like the word flexible. And so I think what I'd like to see is maybe some language built into the plan that says instead of a minimum of two stories here and a minimum of three stories here, if we want to encourage that, I think we could put language into that we would encourage this type, but not necessarily place a minimum in those areas. I think we have a vision, so we might want to encourage that vision, but I don't want to place a minimum if that then becomes the document that's referred to in the ordinance and the document that's referred to in any general plan updates that we do. I think that's my statement.
All right. Any other comments on this? Scott? All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Number three is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the transfer of city properties to A New Leaf, including La Mesita, East Valley Men's Center, and Mesa Can Building.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Ray Villa, I'm the Acting Neighborhood Services Director. With me is Carolyn Nelson, the Housing and Revitalization Director. We're here this morning for your to seek your consideration regarding the transfer of three city-owned properties that are currently being leased by New Leaf. The three properties are La Mesita, East Valley Men's Shelter, and the Mesa Can Building. Even though the three properties have not met the minimum requirements yet for the transfer that council set up back in 2003, one thing that the council can do is review each case on a case-by-case basis. The reason why New Leaf is seeking this is they're currently in the process of improving each one of these sites, and they feel by having the ownership of the property, it would make it more convenient for them to seek out additional funding for those improvements that they need to make. We also believe and support the transfer based on the fact that New Leaf, which is previously known as Prehab, has been a partner with the city for more than 35 years. They have shown that they are physically responsible. They have 375 employees that work for them. They have a $23 million operation, annual operation budget that they work with. And we feel that this would be not only in the best interest of the city, but also of its residents. And we seek your direction in moving in that and to come back with a resolution to do so. And with that, we'll open up to questions.
Okay. Every time this comes forward, I keep asking who else was out there that's going to make applications to get their property transferred. So what other block grant buildings have we acquired that would be next in the queue for people to come forward? Are there several, or is this it, or where are we at?
Well, we have several properties.
And I guess a follow-up on that is maybe we're just doing it wrong. Maybe they should just deal directly with the organization and forget the city.
Mayor Hawker, Lisa Hembry in Housing and Revitalization. In answer to your question on other properties, Care Partnership leases the city-owned property. They built the building. City General funds and CDBG funds purchased the land that they're on. Prehab also has a couple other properties that they lease from the city that were acquired with CDBG funds, and one property that was acquired with general funds that we had to undertake a federal environmental review prior to transfer. And the properties on University are eligible for transfer. The other agency that could possibly come forward that we lease back to is the Child Crisis Center. However, their property is 15 years is up next year, and they express no interest in doing so at this time.
I thought they already came forward.
That was land. That was not the Child Crisis Center itself. That was the property that we purchased for them for a new family resource center at 805 North Country Club. And that's that, currently under construction.
But that was Child Crisis Center?
Yes.
Okay. One of the background information's pieces indicated something about the effect of different federal monies being involved, and if you, which would not allow the transfer. This one, I take it, is one that doesn't have those restrictions on it, so.
That's correct.
All right.
Mayor, just Ray, once you, but we have the five.
Yes.
After the transfer, there'll be a requirement for.
Right. For after each one, because of the fact that we've invested all the CDBG money into each one of these properties, we would have to, in negotiating this, we would have to have some kind of language that would ensure that they would maintain the same kind of use on the property for 5 years.
Right. Is there a potential secondary option that if they wanted the property free and clear in their own name as an organization and they have some donors that don't like the idea that it's owned by the city, that it's a lease property and that they're making improvements to the property that could be the lease terminated or something? I assume that's part of the reason. Could they pay back the CBG monies, and if they had benevolent donors, then have those properties into a nonprofit that didn't have, I assume they could, financial ties to a municipality?
Yes, they could do that.
All right. Okay. All right. You know, I am familiar with all three properties, and I'm familiar with the management. I see no reason not to. In fact, I'm not even sure why we don't just give direct grants to them in the first place, that we have this 15-year thing. But that's, I guess, part of the federal regulations. Tom?
I was going to ask, is it 15 years of federal regulation, or is that part of our internal criteria?
It's part of your own internal criteria that you set back in 2003.
So the federal government doesn't require us to lease it for 15 years before we can transfer?
No, the only requirement that we have from the federal government is that they're supposed to maintain the same use for 5 years after they receive the funding.
The transfer.
That's the only requirement.
Okay. And I guess what I see happening here, I'm not sure it's the same for all three properties, but because of both the state on one of them is wanting to have some grant money and they need to secure their position, and it's difficult for them to secure their position when we're the owner. Second one, there are some private donations that are being offered for remodeling that the donors would feel more comfortable if it was owned by the entity rather than by the city. This is a solid, rock-solid organization, and under those circumstances, I don't have a problem with these three transfers, but like the mayor, the case-by-case analysis is getting a little redundant and a little unnecessary because we don't ever seem to say no. So I'm not sure that we gain much by it. Maybe we need to have a revisit of the 2003 policy, but I certainly support these three transfers.
Vice Mayor.
Mayor, I'm willing to make a motion that we transfer these three properties. Just a reminder, the 2003 decision that we made may have impacted who comes forward with requesting us to do the transfer, because one of the things that we were concerned about was making sure that we weren't having somebody come into the nonprofit world, set up an organization, exist for a short period of time, the five-year minimum, have the property, and then do something different with it. And that's why we were trying to make sure that these were entities that were solid. You know, who can be more solid than Child Crisis Center, than Prehab? I know you're a new leaf, but Mike, I still shop at Price Club, and I went to Mesa Lutheran until it closed. So change your name, but it doesn't change it for me. So I have no problem with what we're doing here. I'm fine with our revisiting it, but there really was a reason for our doing the policy that we did. Prior to that time, we flat out didn't transfer these properties. So I'll make a motion for the transfer.
All right. Motion and second. Discussion? Tom?
As I understand it, we have to, we're just giving direction,
yeah, we just
to prepare
want the
resolutions.
I think we've heard the direction. We'll bring it on the council
right,
agenda.
Right. I don't transfer.
I know you did. You did a great job. And we will bring it back to council.
We have to wait till number five.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Except for adjournment.
Okay. I think we have concurrence then to bring it forward in whatever manner it needs to be so we can do an action.
Sure. Right. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Number four is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on code changes regarding deferral of off-site improvements.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Christine Zalanka with Development Services Department, and this is Beth Huning, our city engineer. We're here today to make a brief presentation on a proposal for your consideration to make modifications to two sections of the City Code Title IX involving off-site improvements or public ways and properties. Under our current city code and the city requirements, new development is essentially required to pay for itself. Specifically, what we're talking about today are infrastructure improvements to right-of-way city-owned property adjacent to that new development. Typically, it includes street improvements and oftentimes utility line extensions or improvements. Under the existing code, a developer would have to actually construct those improvements or provide an in-lieu payment to the city prior to the issuance of building permits. And what we have come to the conclusion is that in some limited cases, it may be in the best interest of the city to actually delay that construction or to defer the requirement for the in-lieu payment. The proposal that we're presenting for your consideration is to allow the deferral either of the in-lieu payment or the actual construction of those off-site improvements only in cases when it would be in the best interest of the city. These situations will primarily be in newly developing areas where the either road improvements or the utilities may not yet be necessary or even be desired. Generally, this is going to be in a situation where there are topographical problems, drainage issues. We're not sure exactly what the final alignment of the road might be, or we're not sure at that point exactly what the utility line requirements may be. Basically, what we're recommending is that the either construction or the in-lieu payment be allowed to be deferred, again, in the city's best interest and when it's approved by the city manager and the council. There are a couple of advantages to the city for this. Number one, it allows us for proper planning of infrastructure when we've got development that may be just a little bit ahead of our infrastructure planning. And also, the cost of the improvements would be in the city's best interest. If we don't plan to build a road for the next 10 years, if we require an in-lieu payment today, obviously that's not going to be enough to actually build the road in 10 years, whereas if we allow deferral and then require the developer to build the road or provide the in-lieu payment at that point in the future, it will be at the actual cost at that time. We are recommending specific restrictions on when this deferral could be considered. It would always be at the city manager's discretion. It would only apply to non-residential development, and that would be for land that is zoned either commercial or industrial. We're proposing that there would be size restrictions, that be that it would have to be 125 acres or greater, or 1 mile total frontage along a city road. Also, that the improvements, road in particular, would not be in the city's regional transportation plan, and that the improvement would not be included in the city's five-year capital improvement plan. The other conditions that we're recommending is that a development agreement would always be required, and a development agreement has to go to the city manager for approval and then eventually to the city council. So any deferral agreement would be approved by the city council. We're requiring or recommending that financial assurance would be required that would be acceptable to both the city engineer and the city attorney. Generally, that would be a performance bond, but it may take the form of some other type of financial assurance that might be appropriate to that particular development. And again, it would be contingent on council's approval through the development agreement. Our specific recommendation is to make a modification to two sections of the code, Title 967, which covers subdivisions, and 984, which covers the off-site improvements. The language would be the same, basically, again, allowing for deferral of the construction or in-lieu payment in these limited circumstances. Our proposal is that we would include these code modifications on the agenda for introduction on November 5th. For council consideration then on November 19th. We're open for questions or any discussion and would ask your direction on how we can move forward.
I was briefed on this earlier, and I agree with the concept that I don't see there's a whole lot of downside for the city that the person building the road pays for it at the time that it needs to be constructed at those costs, as opposed to us calculating what it would be. In fact, I think that's probably even an advantage to the city with construction costs and the unknown. It takes out that factor. My question on it is the size restriction of the 1 mile and 125 acres. If it's a good proposal for 1 mile and 125 acres, why wouldn't it be a good proposal for one lot or a couple hundred feet? So is it the amount of paperwork that's involved or the what?
Mayor,
why not have it available to anyone that wants it?
Well, I've worked with it where it's available to anyone that so desires it. It does become an administrative issue. We were trying to, and it's kind of a judgment call on our part, to find a size that would work for maintaining one or maybe two property owners on that parcel for a large commercial industrial. We are seeing some commercial sites coming in that are going to be then split into multiple lots. And if we have a deferral agreement that's running 10 years with, say, a performance bond, performance bonds have shelf lives on them, so you may get a performance to make them financially affordable. A performance bonds of 2 to 5 years, it may be 10 to 15 years before you want the improvements built. You then, as prior to the bond expiring, staff would have a trigger and they would need to go speak with the bondholder or with the person who filed the bond to either get the bond extended or to call the bond. In many cases, we've seen it where you're dealing with multiple property owners or like a property owners association. They can't deal very well with getting a bond renewed from a prior owner in those types of circumstances, so you'd end up having to call the bond. In most of these cases, if we end up with a larger parcel with a major frontage, and it is cumulative, it's not a mile on one single street, it's like cumulative, a mile over the division, the property, then we can go back and work with one or two owners to get the bonds renewed instead of having to call bonds. So it's a bit of a judgment call, I guess. We also have discussed language that would say that it would be a one lot or one parcel to try and keep it to the one property owner that we're dealing with to renew bonds and deal with financial assurances.
Is there a statement that's filed against the property, too? So if somebody wanted to buy or something with the county recorder, they could see that this was, is that the intent?
That's what the development agreement does. It's recorded against the property, so any transfers then, that information would be part of the deal.
Okay. I'm just struggling with it's okay for the big, but it's not for the small stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Darryl.
My understanding is this is always going to be basically a city option as opposed to a developer option. So I'm not sure that I'm with you. I don't know why, if it's our option, why don't we lower the requirements and then we can, in policy implementation, just do it for larger parcels unless the instance comes up that it makes sense for a smaller parcel.
Kyle?
Christine, when we discussed this in my office, mm-hmm. you knew this was coming up.
Oh, absolutely.
So that, it, and I think that's a feeling myself too. I do not want to make the restriction because I think that administratively you can determine the appropriateness of each project. So I don't want to put it just for the big parcels. I would like it to be. We don't want to get it where it's not manageable.
Right.
But by the same token, administratively, you can determine what is appropriate.
Okay. Am I hearing that you don't want any size restriction at all to just eliminate that?
That's my feeling. I mean, if you're a developer or you're a property owner, I mean, the economics of doing a bond and doing the rest on a small one will dictate that it's not feasible. They'll pay the undue and go. So let that play out instead of saying, you know, if you're a big guy, you get a break. If you think you want it, another option for you. But if you're a little one, you can't even consider it. I just don't like that as a policy consideration.
Okay. Right. Yeah. We'll just eliminate the size restriction altogether.
I would say so.
Okay.
Vice Mayor.
Yeah, as long as we have the option to say yay or nay, then you're sure. Fine. Could you explain to me how the performance bond works? I had the question of here of how long can it remain in place, but you already answered that one. So how does it work?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, actually what the code restrictions or the code changes will say is financial assurance. There are a variety of financial assurances. I think the most commonly and widely used is the performance bond, but it goes to the ability of the property owner to bond. And it typically runs in the cost or the neighborhood cost of 1 to 10%, depending on the value of the project, the duration of the bond, and the financial capability to bond of the company bonding. So, and the way those work is they're drawn by a bonding company. We get a document that we would then retain. They do have a shelf life or an expiration date. Prior to that, we would have a staff member kind of monitoring those dates 6 months prior. We would contact the holder of that bond and notify them it's going to change and talk to them about whether to extend it or it potentially, I guess we could end up calling those bonds.
So let me talk about what that amount would be. You have a road that you're thinking you're going to need to build. Today, the construction cost on that road is $10 million. I'm making up numbers, you understand. Mm-hmm. Today is $10 million. You anticipate in 5 years when the bond would expire that it might cost $15 million to, how do you pick a number that you're bonding against? I guess that's what I'm getting at.
I think the way the code is set up, we would get a design and the cost of the bond would be set for any planning and design of the project as well as construction, and then we have contingencies and then we add on 20% to get to some form of inflation 2 to 5 years from now when the bond would expire. The way the development agreements will be crafted is that at that time, if they wish to renew the bond, instead of having us call it, we will renegotiate those costs based on...
And that was my next question.
Yeah.
Okay, so you go back and you renegotiate it. Could somebody, and now I'm looking over here, Alfred, how does this differ from the ruling that we had previously about unenforceability of deferred in-lieu payments or deferred payments on things? I seem to recall Neil Beetz had written an opinion that said that, you know, then the property sells and it isn't enforceable. Is that because of the bonds? Okay, so I was looking at the wrong attorney. Jim?
Good morning, Mayor, Councilmember. There was a prior memo by the city attorney, Neil Beetz. It involved a prior agreement, which I don't think was recorded on the property, and it also didn't involve performance bonds. They also, the prior agreement that was used didn't have the level of specificity that we are drafting in our current development agreement that we're working on with this. And even within Neil Beetz's opinion, as I remember it, he said that he could recraft the agreement so that it would be have greater specificity, but the council at that time still took the direction of going with the current language, which says that you have to first either pay the in lieu or do the construction prior to the permits.
So you don't have any problem with the enforceability of this, the way it's being crafted now?
Well, it's not tested, is I guess the way I phrase it. And I think we have sort of two mechanisms to provide security to the city. One is the financial assurance, the bond, or other provided financial assurance. The other is the development agreement, the contractual obligation, which will be recorded against the property. And one of the reasons why we put in here that it wouldn't be wouldn't be used for residential property is to avoid the possibility of having to enforce a development agreement against individual homeowners on their lots. And so that's why we did that.
I know that was one of the concerns before. And so what, you know, we may want to look at is if somebody comes in with a single family residential, that might be one of the ones we don't want to take.
The current language would not allow that. We're not going to do it on any residential property.
I'm sorry. So you were only talking about commercial, you would go to zero. You weren't suggesting, okay, I thought they were suggesting that they would just remove it entirely. All right.
No,
thank you.
The proposal only allows it for commercial and industrial zone property.
I'm fine then. Thank you.
Well, you could allow it for residential, but it would be so restrictive that every single property that would have, and you'd have to bond each one, yes. And there would be no way anyone would want to do the cost. So practically, you could do it. I mean, well, theoretically, you could do it. Practically, you could do it. Yeah. All right, Tom.
Okay. I guess I'm a little concerned about what the price of the bond is, or what the bond is going to be, is, and Claudia's hypothetical, and if we're going to say we're going to add in all the contingencies, then we're going to add 20% if it's a 2-year bond or 40% if it's a 3-year bond. I think if we're going to do that, we need to be very precise and use the same inflation number that we're using with our CPIs, et cetera, so that we have, it's not just picking a number out of the hat, we're actually using the numbers that we're using for our budgeting. Because that puts it more into a real-world scenario. I think it's more defensible if it's tied to the same level of the same inflation factor that we're using in our budgeting. And the other thing we talked about in my office, the financial assurances. I'm not quite sure why we have this two-level thing, a three-level thing. The financial assurances have to be approved by the engineer, the city attorney, and then they get put into the development agreement. What if the city attorney and the engineer say performance bond, and it comes to the council and the development agreement, and we've got General Motors or IBM, and we feel fairly comfortable that they're going to be able to perform 5 years down the road, and we don't think a performance bond is necessary. Do we have that flexibility to say we'll just have their written promise is good enough for us?
Yeah, Jimmy, I'll ask you to answer. But I don't think the issue has to do with their, I mean, it has to do both with their wherewithal to pay it, but it's their commitment to pay it. I guess it's just that leverage. Does the bond give us something more than just someone who's highly, you know, credit, you know, well, you know, has a strong balance sheet?
And I was thinking about the current language, how it's drafted, and what the necessary redrafting to do that. The language is financial assurance, so it wouldn't necessarily have to be a performance bond. It could be a letter of credit. And so right. Someone like GM would, I think, be able to easily be able to get a letter of credit from a banking institution at little or no cost. And so the assurance does not necessarily have to be a bond.
No, and I understand that. And I'm just, again, I can just see myself, though, as the councilman deciding on the development agreement, that I really feel comfortable that IBM is going to be around in 5 years, and I don't even want them to have to pay the 1% premium on their letter of credit. I'm not saying I would, but I'd like to have that flexibility. Now, if it's, you know, John Doe down the street who's developing a piece of property and doesn't have quite the same balance sheet, I'd probably want a performance bond or a letter of credit. But I can envision times where I would think that would be an unnecessary burden on the business. I don't mean that it's going to break them. I'm just thinking that it's unnecessary. So I would just like to have some flexibility on the part of the council to say, you know, sign the development agreement, make the written promise, we'll file it against the land, and if you don't do it, you know, we'll come after you.
I haven't given it much thought, but the financial assurance may in and of itself just be the development agreement. I guess arguably at some point you could say that development agreement with a particular entity that has given you their contractual obligation, you might be able to say that the development agreement itself
and
is the financial
assurance. That's all I'm saying is have the flexibility where we can say your signature on the development agreement, your balance sheet, your rating is assurance enough for us. Now, next person, we don't have that same comfort level, so I want a bond, I want a letter of credit, I want your second born child, you know, whatever it is. I think the council ought to be able to have that.
The challenge we have is, and the example you're given, we could maybe probably get there. Our experience is, in the development industry, is the creation of a lot of these shells, organizations that are very issue specific or whatever. So that's just I don't disagree with you under your example. I think we're basing this on experience, but I think if we have the flexibility, we bring a development agreement and you say to us, I'm comfortable with this entity and who they are. I think it'll just require some due diligence on our part a little bit to figure out really who is that entity that is part of the agreement.
If we're not comfortable, then we shouldn't do it without the performance bond if we don't know or if we have uncertainty.
Sure.
But I guess it then brings me back to my language issue is why there's the city engineer and the city attorney's blessing on the financial assurances before it gets to us.
Is it just for that purposes or?
They're going to have to review the cost estimates, the city engineer is.
I agree. The numbers are right. But I mean, that isn't what it says. It says provides financial assurances acceptable to the city engineer and the city attorney.
I guess that was a process that they would have to be acceptable at the staff level before we would ever move them forward for the city manager and the council's consideration.
Right, but the staff's comfort level is always subject to council override.
Sure.
Yes.
But the way it's written, it's not. It's basically you got to have staff's got to be comfortable and the attorney's got to be comfortable, and then the council has to be comfortable, but the council can't be comfortable at any level less than what the engineer and the attorney have said, and I don't think that's what we mean.
Councilmember Rawls, I'm not necessarily sure that's accurate, though, because we contemplate that our office will be drafting the development agreement, more likely than not with Jim, with the assurances that Christine and Beth are on board, but ultimately they will come to you, and notwithstanding that we have said we are comfortable with the financial assurances, if we've said a performance bond and you say, well, no, I'm okay with just their signature on it, ultimately it will be within your purview to change that. So if you would like the language to say something to the effect financial services comfortable to the city council or to the city, I guess we could make that recommendation. But ultimately,
I think what Christine was saying, we would not be moving something forward that we did not initially feel comfortable with
and
doing.
I understand that, and I think that's all I'm asking for is, again, for the flexibility for the council to make the kind of decision that says, I feel comfortable, we feel comfortable, and therefore we can move forward.
And as I said, I think you retain that because ultimately if you tell us you're not going to approve this development agreement, since you have to vote on it and approve it, you retain ultimate decision-making authority on that.
Okay, I don't want to beat this, but because we're trying to introduce it on Monday,
sure,
we have to have the language right
okay. Today.
And I'm just saying that, hypothetically, let's say that the staff says the proposal, the development agreement that comes forward to us has engineer and city attorney's recommendation that a $10 million performance bond or letter of credit be posted. Comes to the council, and the council says, we don't think that's required. You just said we could turn down the development agreement. Well, that doesn't advance the project because we've now just turned down the development agreement. Can we modify the development agreement to reflect, to change it over the and see, my problem is that the way that it's written in here, it specifically says provides financial assurance acceptable to the city engineer and the city attorney. I don't understand why that language is in there because it seems to bind us to that level.
Then Councilman, then if you're concerned about that language, I think the more appropriate role for that part of the staff, frankly, is to provide to you the estimate of the cost and those technicalities.
Exactly.
But at some level, I'm assuming there are members of the council that are going to want staff to tell you whether or not they believe whether the financial ability of this party that we're proposing to allow a deferral is sufficient to do that. And so somewhere, whether it's anybody sitting here or otherwise, I'm assuming you're going to want the staff to have recommended to you that yes or no, or what form of financial assurance there should be.
And I agree. They can make a recommendation, but as I read the draft ordinance, it seems to lock us in.
Mayor, and the reason why that language is used is actually it's similar to language that is in the code currently and in development agreements. The council historically, I don't think, has had the sort of final veto on financial assurance. In the subdivision code, the assurance for offsite, I believe, is approved by the city engineer. I think a similar provision is also provided in Section 9.8 of the code. In development agreements that you've approved historically, you've said that the financial assurances will be determined by the city engineer and city attorney. In fact, Mountain Bridge, which was approved a few months ago, said that exactly. And so this language tracks language similar to what this council's approved in the past. If you'd like to change it where it's sort of an initial recommendation or it's an approval by staff, but ultimately you have sort of a veto power to change the financial assurance when the development agreement's approved, we can do that. The language, though, is just so you know, is consistent with what we've done historically.
Scott?
Actually, that last conversation captured the question. Seeing the language, but I tend to lean a little bit toward more assurance from a city's perspective of making sure that we have sufficient funds or bonds or assurances, legal and otherwise, to actually construct. Because down, pardon the pun, but down road, if in years coming forward, we don't have the money, then it ends up being a burden on the taxpayers. So I would rather have those financial assurances in place. And I don't have the necessary background legally or financially or from an engineering perspective. So I'm going to need that input from staff in order to make an informed decision.
I'm not looking for the flexibility as a council member or as mayor to approve one where they have to post a bond and another one where they've been around for a number of years and I trust that they'll still be there to perform. The market's going to take that into account on what they charge for the bonding. So they already get the benefit of being very financially stable. I don't want to be one that says, and you don't have to do it at all, but this guy does because I don't trust him as much. Let the market and the bonding companies and the private industry establish those rates. I'm not interested in giving somebody a free pass because I happen to think they're going to be here for a while. So that would be my input onto it. So I think we have maybe a little difference of opinion on that. Darrell.
One question I wanted to ask is this only going to apply where the city and the developer mutually agree to defer?
Absolutely. The development agreement is a negotiated document, and I would not anticipate ever bringing forward a development agreement that wasn't a consensus agreement between the city and the developer.
So I am kind of in your camp. If the developer wants to defer these costs, there must be some financial reason for him to do so and some good reason to do so, and he should weigh that with the cost of paying a 0.5% or whatever for a certificate of deposit. Or a deposit or whatever, that then would let him defer those costs for five years or more.
Vice Mayor.
Thanks, Mayor. I have sat here a few times as people came and made appeals to us and on their on the amount that they were being charged for fees and making the statement that they were good people and the kind of people we should want in the city, and therefore it shouldn't cost them as much. My feeling is that the history of businesses is such that we can look at Pan Am, Eastern Airlines, American Motors, and all those companies that at one time were very strong, steady companies that, you know, hit some rough times. And some of them, I think everyone I just mentioned, is no longer in existence, at least as it originally was formed. So I am not interested in having something that allows somebody not to have some sort of letter of credit, bonding, something like that. I don't think that the council should take a handshake deal on a road project that's this big instead of taking, you know, the bird in the hand, the money today. So I'm not comfortable with that as even being a possibility.
So,
in essence, we're looking for direction for as a whole, then I will go in that same direction. I wanted the flexibility for the size, but I think for the assurance, since it's negotiated, that we need to have that assurance there.
Yeah, I really think the large, stable company that would probably be given a pass is their bonding requirements and cost would be minimal anyway, because they've already established a great credit throughout the market. So the market, in this case, I think should be setting those rates, and then the person can charge, figure out what their borrowing costs are versus bonding, and just make a business decision on it, and we stay out of it. Again, I think you've got more of a consensus to go in that direction.
Yes.
On that one.
Great.
Anything
thank
else on this?
That's it.
All right, but
thank
I think let's move it forward with that option available.
Okay.
All right. Number five, this is the time for a motion. Acknowledging receipts of minutes of various boards and committees.
Oh, thank you, Mayor. Move for approval.
All right. Motion second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. Hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Scott.
Well, for the last few days, I was in at the Grand Canyon at the Arizona Town Hall, which with a number of our state legislators and folks talking about land use and creating a consensus document for Arizona. I've learned the hard way that consensus building is a blood sport. So I'm feeling a little punched up today. The good news is we tackled some issues that are very relevant to Mesa and our growth. We looked at the state as a whole, but state trust land reform and coming to some agreement on having to go forward to voters fairly soon on what we're going to do with those parcels was talked about. We also talked about the fact that a lot of these communities that spring up in the middle of nowhere have to have a 100-year water plan, but that plan doesn't include sustainability of the water. So we talked about switching from the one-year water plan to sustainability. Now you know why I'm so beat up. But beyond that, we have to have a 100-year water plan, but there's no plan or study required for infrastructure and the impact on that infrastructure or having to pay for that infrastructure. Case in point, Johnson's Ranch. Folks living out there have to drive through the freeways. There's very limited access. Anthem is another example of a fine development, but the infrastructure is insufficient. So some of these items are what came up and will be in the document. So that was quite a bit of fun, I suppose.
Anyone else?
No? Sure. Sure. See that. And those are basically just recommendations from the town hall. How much did you
see that going then to the state legislature?
Well, they are recommendations, and the good news with Arizona Town Hall is it's cited by quite a few legislators and other entities, and does from time to time lead to significant tangible policies. Hopefully what we see with this document is we see more state legislatures taking a look at this from state trust land, and it doesn't just apply to the state too. Local municipalities can adopt some of these recommendations, but this is hopefully will direct the discussion and open a lot of folks' eyes to some of the problems with state land planning. You're going to beat me up again?
Mm-hmm. 3 days of this.
No, I guess my other question is, I think the thing that's probably of most significance is the state land reform.
Right.
You see, now this is more asking an opinion now. Do you see us going towards some sort of consensus on something that where we don't have competing interests between the environmentalists and the home builders and everybody putting out different proposals? And
well,
or how do we engage those people to come up with some consensus and something meaningful?
There were certainly folks on all sides of the table, all political spectrums. We had home builders and environmentalists that were involved with this process that came to this particular consensus. Now, whether we can get the larger community to agree and go forward with one very clear-cut decision on state trust land, most of ours dealt with a lot of how we're going to sell it, providing better funding to the state land department, some reform of state land department, exchanges of land from between public entities so that we can have the preservation of land where necessary, but also take lands that are currently state trust that would be better off for being built upon, have that go off onto the market. So I think there was a lot of consensus there. Hopefully that'll drive the conversation. We can actually get some real state trust land reform in the next couple of years.
Any other updates, Vice Mayor?
Thank you, Mayor. Just a couple of them. I attended a Mana Club event. They're a great service club in our community. Ladies who provide scholarships do great things, and they had a nice event. Also, Latino Town Hall events on Friday night and then again on Saturday morning. And the participation seems to increase every year, and they're evolving in as they find ways to involve people more. Also, Art on the Move. You and I were there on Saturday evening, a major fundraiser to help fund programs for youths over at the Art Center and other programs. Thank you.
Councilmember Jones.
I just want to ask Scott more questions.
Oh, shut up.
In the water discussion, was there any discussion in regard to... Come on, put your head up,
hey,
Scott.
You gotta,
it's okay.
You
already had your caffeine.
I told you it was a blood sport. What are you guys doing to me?
No, the question I have is, did the discussion come up regarding recharge for areas where they draw out of an aquifer and recharge somewhere else, not back into that aquifer?
It did not make the consensus document.
Really?
It really did not make the consensus document.
All right.
Another study session.
Yeah. All right. There are some policy decisions that are going forward in AMWA and what we want to, if anything, do at the legislature this year. So it might be worthwhile having Catherine Sorensen come in and do a little briefing on what AMWA's position is and City of Mesa being a member. So all of what you've talked about is part of what we've had those discussions on. So that might be a good study session item at some point to just get an update and briefing. Right. Any other meetings? All right. Are here meetings and conferences, scheduling meetings, and general information, Mr. Brady?
Thank you, Mayor. Reminder to the council that this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. we'll have City Hall at the Mall at Superstition Springs. So we invite you all out there. We have, I think we said, 15, are we at 15 departments, Kevin, something in that number? It will be there to provide information and some level of services. I think we have a mock election going on, is that right, from the city clerk's office? So
that's right, Mr. Brady. We're going to have the children vote for the mayor of Kid City, and we're going to be charting their votes up on a board at the end, and we'll have prizes.
So that should be a lot of fun, so we invite everyone out to that.
Scott's running.
And then on Monday, reminder that Monday, November 5th, this coming Monday, we have a General and Economic Development Committee meeting at 3:45, and that will be followed by our City Council study session and council meeting. And then we have our Thursday, November 8th, we have about, I think we have 6 items for that study session. So we expect that to go a little bit longer than we normally do for study sessions. So we invite you to schedule your time for that day. And then the following day, Friday, November 9th, is our transportation roadshow. We'll invite all those who are interested in going on the roadshow, which will begin here at 8 a.m. in the lobby, and then we'll take you over to the transportation department to look at their screens and the way they track the traffic from their kind of their central station. What is that referred to, Jack? Okay, and so then we'll go on the road with the bus to the different proposed intersections and proposed streets that are included in the proposed November 2008 bond. And then finally, earlier this morning, and yes, there was an earlier this morning than 7:30 this morning, Jack and Carrie and I were out at the with the solid waste department, the truck drivers, met with them to recognize Bill Cummings, one of our drivers who competed nationally back in New Jersey under the Solid Waste Truck Rodeo, and he placed second nationally for in that competition. So pretty remarkable recognition for him. So we're pretty very proud of our drivers in Mesa. Thank you, Mayor.
You mentioned the upcoming study session with lots of items on it.
Yes.
Is if one of those is home rule, and I think at some point we get to talk about home rule again, I'd like to include in that if the council wants to look at a budget alternative if home rule did not pass, or whether we want to avoid going into that type of discussion at this point.
Okay. If Mayor, I was concerned also when we were viewing the agenda, we recognize we're calling that election for home rule on Monday, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. And then so we'll have a discussion on the 8th. That says just have that discussion is what you're suggesting about a contingency plan if it's not approved in March.
Yeah, or if we even want to go there. We haven't in the past, and I don't want to go into a scare tactic.
Right.
Here's what has to be cut, but I think we have to have the discussion on whether we want to engage in that type of backup or not.
Okay, we can add it to the 8th agenda.
All right, Vice Mayor.
I still have that the 8th as our council retreat. Are you just calling it a super study session? Are we no longer having a council retreat? So we're doing it here as opposed to how we've done it in the past and going someplace else?
Right. If you call it, as I visited with individuals, that was kind of the preference of the council. Certainly we have time if you want to open it up to more than that. We try to pick some of the broader topics.
Okay. But there will be food, right, Chris?
Yes, ma'am. This is the one meeting of the year that we actually allow for you to eat.
You're baking, right, Chris? And you'll have fruit for me.
Sure,
right?
Us and Bashes, I'm sure.
Okay, I just wanted to know if we were going to really have kind of that discussion of the broader issues in a little more.
We could. Open I mean, if way, the council would prefer, we could maybe have one item that allows for us to talk about upcoming priorities of budget issues. For the next year, if you'd like to do that too.
Well, I'm just
right now they're very specific topics that are on the list.
I'm okay with the specific topics. It's just always been a little bit more free form than a study session, and that's why.
Yeah, we tried to have it completely open and couldn't post it accordingly. Was the difficulty there? But I think something on budget issues certainly that is as broad as we can, so we can
absolutely.
Incorporate.
And then that would be good for us to have.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Can you send out the draft of the items?
Yes, we can at least give you the list. Right. They're all familiar that you've heard. We've talked about in the past. So.
Okay. All right. Item number 8 is items from citizens present. Were there any requests?
No requests, Mayor.
Right. Motion and second to adjourn. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned.